A quick warning. This episode contains descriptions of violence and death. We advise listener discretion.
Well, good morning.
It's 9 a.m. on a Wednesday morning.
We're going to open the record in this proceeding with regard to application 95-501 for a groundwater permit.
This is Government Exhibit 942 from the trial of Timothy McVeigh. It's a recording of an Oklahoma Water Resources Board hearing.
My name's Lou Claver, and I've been designated by the 9-member Oklahoma Water Resources Board to serve as the hearing.
Cynthia Lou Claver was presiding over a dispute between two adjoining landowners about whether one would be allowed to start a bottled water company.
Basically, what happens is we'll present evidence here, evidence from the applicant, ask questions, hear from the protestant with regard to why the application shouldn't be granted.
The Water Resources Board was headquartered in a three-story cement structure across the street from the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in downtown Oklahoma City. The audio was played for the jury in McVeigh's trial from the very beginning of the tape, which started at the stroke of 9 a.m. The gray monotone of Lou Claver's voice reminded everyone of the mundane way that April 19th began. But the bureaucratic drone was excruciating because everyone in the courtroom knew what was coming at 2 minutes after 9.
With regard to this proceeding, basically there are four elements that I have to receive information regarding them.
And good morning, everyone. I'm Matt Lauer in New York, and we do have a special report from NBC News. There has been a massive explosion at a federal building in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. It happened just a short time ago. A large portion of that building has...
I remember exactly where I was when the Oklahoma City bombing happened.
I think there is an amazing, ravenous appetite for information about O.J. Simpson.
I was somewhere in a crowd of reporters on the 9th floor of the criminal courts building in Los Angeles, covering O.J.
Inside the court building, another zoo. Reporters sit glued to small monitors, watching, waiting for any new evidence in the case that's captured the attention of the world.
That's Nicole's mother and sister.
We got word of the bombing during a break in Judge Ito's courtroom. And I remember my reaction. What am I doing here? Why am I covering a celebrity murder in L.A. when something so much more important was happening in Oklahoma? And it was more important. 168 people killed, 19 of them children.
The powerful blast ripped off the front of the 9-story office building. 500 federal workers were already
Oklahoma
in
the Oklahoma City federal building, the apparent terrorist attack striking America's heartland and also at America's hearts as well.
But even though everyone knew Oklahoma City was more important than O.J., pretty soon the world's attention shifted back to the Simpson trial. I know I covered it all the way through to the verdict. That may not say much for the news media, or for me, but that's what happened. Almost 2 years after the O.J. verdict, in the Oklahoma City bombing case, I covered the trial of Timothy McVeigh in 1997. And I covered both Simpson and McVeigh in the same kind of way, like true crime stories. We focused on the evidence, the bloody glove in O.J., the Ryder truck axle in McVeigh. It was all about the how and not the why. But I've come to feel that I really missed something with that approach to Oklahoma City. Sure, it was a true crime story, but it was so much more. It was actually a story that transcended crime, even terrorism, and it told us something about our politics right up to the present day. We do know why McVeigh killed all those people. He said that the bombing happened because he was a patriot. Timothy McVeigh could quote the Founding Fathers from memory. One of his favorite passages was from Patrick Henry's famous 1775 speech, the one that concluded with, "Give me liberty or give me death." McVeigh recited what else Henry had said, quote, "If we wish to be free, if we mean to preserve inviolate those inestimable privileges for which we have been so long contending, we must fight. I repeated, sir, we must fight. At the Murrah Building, McVeigh fought. There have been other violent events in the past 25 years that were motivated by the same kind of warped sense of patriotism as McVeigh's, but the most stark was January 6, 2021.
Because you'll never take back our country with weakness. You have to show strength and you have to be strong.
The spirit of rebellion was in the air that day.
Awareness. Be advised, there's probably about 300 Proud Boys.
USA!
Like McVeigh, the rioters who stormed the Capitol were seemingly normal citizens whose zealotry led them to believe that the ends justify the means.
It's up to us people now, the American people. And whatever it takes, I'll lay my life down if it takes.
Absolutely. That's why we showed up today.
Hold on! Hold on!
McVeigh said he committed the Oklahoma City bombing because he wanted to start another American revolution, a civil war. He said, "I believe there is an army out there, ready to rise up, even though I never found it." The army is out there. It's out there now. And that makes the story of Timothy McVeigh, what he did and why he did it, not just a glimpse of the past, but also a warning about the future. I'm Jeffrey Toobin, and this is Homegrown. Episode 1, The Blueprint.
Well, John, I'd like to just start at the beginning with what your job was and where you were. You were at work at the forensics lab, is that right? Can you tell us where that was and what you were doing?
Okay, on April 19th, I was assigned to nervous.
This interview is from the Oral History Collection at the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum. We'll be using interviews from the memorial throughout this story.
Do I need to start over?
No, just tell us where you were.
Yeah, I was in the equine lab at 717 Concord.
On the morning of April 19th, Oklahoma Police Sergeant John Avera was moving some DNA equipment to a new police lab. He was about five blocks from the Murrah Building when he heard the explosion.
I thought at that point that somebody had blown up the police station right across the street.
Ceiling tiles fell on Avera, and dust started flying everywhere.
So I left the building immediately. When I got outside, I saw the big, I call it a mushroom-type cloud, or big cloud of black smoke. And when I saw the smoke, I just immediately started running that direction.
Throughout April 19th, images from Oklahoma City were broadcast across the country, and the death toll kept rising.
At the moment, we don't have any specific numbers on injuries or deaths.
There are unconfirmed reports that as many as 80 people have perished, and with each passing minute, it's feared more will be found dead. More bodies will be found.
And then came the news about the children.
The death toll has now hit 31 people. At least 18 of those are children. At last check, 300 people are still not accounted for. Many.
Officer Avera ran to the Murrah Building. He sprinted past the Oklahoma Water Resources Board building and arrived at the bomb site.
And somebody ran up to me and said there was a daycare center inside the Murrah Building.
There was a daycare inside. Avera started forcing his way into the Murrah Building. There was debris everywhere. Avera crawled over a barricade of copy machines, desks, and office equipment.
It actually reminded me of some of the old barns back when I was a kid on the farm, somebody's old barn that they just kept throwing all their junk in for 40 years.
Avera and another responder first found two injured women.
The explosion had blown their shoes off, had blown their stockings and ripped them off the bottom of their feet. So they couldn't walk at all. So they basically had to be carried from the building out there.
John took the women onto the street, which was now covered in shards of black glass, and he immediately went back into the building.
I could hear some people screaming, and so I proceeded on down the hallway into the heart of the building. Then we found some people that were in there that were injured and buried in the by the main elevator shafts. And we started digging them out.
Avira found a woman trapped deep under the concrete and rubble. He could only see her hand and her foot, but she could still talk.
But while I was talking to her, I heard a baby choking.
Avira and another sergeant headed toward the sound, trying to move heavy pieces of concrete out of the way. John looked down into a hole and saw a baby struggling. The other sergeant picked the baby up and ran toward the street. John looked down again, and he saw another baby.
I picked up the baby, and the legs and arms were broken. And I had to get out of the building, and I knew that I couldn't crawl back out the way I came in carrying the baby, so I started looking for a new way out.
While holding the baby, John made his way to the Murrah Building's parking garage, and he escaped to the street outside.
I was surprised, because I guess I'd been in there longer than I thought. But I could see people, injured people, laying on the sidewalk or on the street curb up there. And I remember seeing blood running down the curb itself. And then it kind of ruined me for a shock. I was trying to find someone to give the baby to. Everybody seemed to be extremely busy. I mean, it was not a easy thing to do.
John eventually found a firefighter captain named Chris Fields.
He just held his arms out to take it, and I placed the baby in his arms and immediately turned around and ran back in the building.
At that precise moment, a 25-year-old bank employee and aspiring photographer named Charles Porter came upon the scene. He pointed his camera and clicked the shutter. Later that afternoon, Porter took the film to a local Walmart to be developed, and when he picked the pictures up, the clerk began to cry when she looked at one image in particular. At the suggestion of a friend, Porter took that picture to the local office of the Associated Press, where the photo editor put it out on the AP wire. That photo showed the baby, a girl named Bailey Allman, sprawled in Chris Field's arms. The baby's head was bloodied, and her right arm and both legs were limp. The sun illuminated the firefighter's red helmet, but his face was otherwise in shadow. You've probably seen the picture. It became a symbol of the nightmare of April 19th. America's Kids. That was the name of the daycare center on the second floor of the Murrah Building. That morning, 21 children, all preschoolers, were there to play and learn. At 9 a.m., it was song time when the bomb struck. 15 children at the daycare, including one-year-old Bailey, were killed. As the horrific images from Oklahoma City filled the news, the immediate question became, who could possibly have done this? And the initial presumptions about the perpetrator said a lot about America's blind spot on domestic extremism.
Well, it started like any other day, and I remember vividly had a piece of pumpkin pie and a cup of coffee for breakfast.
On the morning of April 19th, 1995, Imad Inshasi was working as the general manager of a restaurant in the French Market Mall, about 8 miles from downtown Oklahoma City. Every morning, Imad took the cash from the previous day's sales to the bank. And to be safe, he had a waitress follow him to his car.
I unlocked the door and I was walking right in the hall of the mall with the deposit in my hand and with the waitress right behind me. And all of a sudden, 9:03, we heard this explosion.
Before moving to Oklahoma, Imad had grown up in Beirut during the Lebanese Civil War. When he heard the distant explosion, it sounded familiar, and Imad immediately thought, a car bomb.
Unfortunately, growing up in a war-torn zone, you could get to distinguish between a gas explosion and a car explosion. And instead of having this normal feeling of sadness and grief that people are dying, we're scared.
Imad thought, please God, don't let it be a Muslim who did this. Ahmad returned to the restaurant where customers were talking about the news. He knew all the regulars there, and Ahmad chatted with one of them.
You know, I sit down with him all the time. We talk politics and so on. And I said, have you heard what happened downtown? That's terrible. And he looked me straight in the eye in front of maybe tens of customers. He said, you people have better not have done this.
You people better not have done this. Ahmad was shaken and he went home.
And I was glued to the TV to see what's happening. And the reports come in of a brown truck, two Middle Eastern guys fleeing the scene.
Two of the three suspects have been described as Middle Eastern men with dark hair and beards. The driver of the pickup truck that is being sought has not yet been identified.
And then all of a sudden, all the reports are talking about mosques within the Oklahoma City area, a Muslim organization within the Oklahoma City area.
It turned out that one of the Middle Eastern men in the pickup truck was Ahmad's friend, a man named Ibrahim Ahmad. A neighbor had called the FBI and said that Ibrahim Ahmad seemed to be in a hurry.
He was leaving his house, but he was in a hurry because he was going overseas and he was late for the airport.
Ibrahim Ahmad was stopped during a layover in Chicago and subjected to a humiliating six-hour interrogation. He was on his way to Jordan, but he was detained again in London. Authorities asked Ahmad about his religion. Did he attend a mosque? Did he pray? Ibrahim Ahmad was then sent back to the United States, where he was detained.
And as you mentioned, they suspect it is an act of terrorism that was perpetrated by people from the Middle East. Here's more on that.
In the mid-90s, fear of Islamic terrorism was in the air. On February 26, 1993, there was the first attack on the World Trade Center in New York, and there were similarities to the strike at the Murrah Building. Just about 2 months before the Oklahoma City bombing, Ramzi Youssef, the mastermind of the World Trade Center attack, was arrested in Pakistan. That was a clear act of Islamic terrorism. Was Oklahoma City another? No. No, it wasn't. Just 2 days after the bombing, it became very clear that Oklahoma City was something very different. On Friday, April 21st, Timothy McVeigh was in an orange jumpsuit walking out of the Noble County Courthouse in Perry, Oklahoma. A throng of news cameras caught the image of him, a white man, an Army veteran with a brush-top crew cut, a right-wing extremist. In McVeigh's car, authorities found a legal-sized envelope containing a few dozen pieces of paper. There were quotations from the Founding Fathers. There was a copy of the Declaration of Independence with McVeigh's handwriting at the bottom. It read, "Obey the Constitution of the United States and we won't shoot you." There was a bumper sticker that said, "When the government fears the people, there is liberty. When the people fear the government, there is tyranny." Beneath that, McVeigh scrawled, "Maybe now there will be liberty." The Oklahoma City bombing was a clear act of homegrown domestic terrorism.
At the tone, please say your name.
It's Tim at El Reno.
Please hold while we attempt to obtain acceptance of the charges.
A few months after his arrest, Timothy McVeigh called James Nichols, the brother of his co-conspirator, Terry Nichols.
Please go ahead.
Yes, with whom am I speaking?
Who's this?
It's Tim.
Tim.
Hey, good to talk to you, James.
What the hell are you doing calling me, man?
Listen, man, your number's busy. I'm trying to get through and the number's busy.
Damn, I just got a phone call and somebody's playing music. About 2 minutes on my recorder angles. What the hell's going on here?
McVeigh wanted to warn James not to send him any mail because he knew that the feds were watching.
Well, listen, I just want to advise you really quick of one new trick in the bag of tricks that was thrown into play today, okay? They're seizing the mail, at least mine, under the guise of continuing investigation.
You get a good sense of McVeigh from this call. Smug, confident, unapologetic.
So don't have anybody send anything, you know, like Bob or anything. I haven't gotten mail for 2 days, and it's quickly evident where it's going. Because, you know, there's never been a day when I haven't got any mail.
Wow.
So,
they're seizing it completely? Or?
Yeah, completely. They had... we learned that they were doing it.
There are not a lot of recordings of McVeigh out there, and as a result, McVeigh is kind of flat in our national consciousness. Just some lunatic who's not worth thinking too much about. In order to fill out who McVeigh really was, I wanted to talk to the man who's probably spent more time thinking about him than anyone else, his lawyer, Stephen Jones.
So lead the way.
Oh, sure,
Where
of course.
Would you like to talk?
Well, since this is audio, I assume that probably the living room was the best place for the interview.
Stephen Jones lives a couple of hours north of Oklahoma City in a house so regal that it has a name. It's called Elmstead. Elmstead was modeled after Mount Vernon, George Washington's historic home. For about 2 years, Stephen Jones was in almost constant contact with Timothy McVeigh. He first met his notorious client on Monday, May 8, 1995, when Jones drove to the El Reno prison outside Oklahoma City.
As I walked in, he stood up, and I walked over to him, extended my hand. He shook it, and I said, Mr. McVeigh, my name is Stephen Jones. I've been appointed by the federal court to represent you. And he said, well, I heard you were coming. And I said, well, why don't you sit down a little bit and tell me about yourself and the marshals, and the warden withdrew, and so we were alone for about 20 minutes. And it was a light conversation. I asked him if he had made a statement. He said no. And I said, well, everything you say over the telephone, except perhaps talking to me, is tape recorded, and you may be assured that they will listen to it. And they're going to be watching you. He said he understood, very cordial. Certainly, he gave the appearance of cooperation and earnestness.
In time, the relationship between Jones and McVeigh would disintegrate. But let's be clear about one thing from the start. From day one, McVeigh told his lawyer that he did bomb the Murrah building. McVeigh was proud of it. He also said that he acted alone, though with a little help from Terry Nichols. The next day, Jones returned to the prison to walk through the whole story.
My memory is that I got there about 10 o'clock, and I didn't leave till 10 p.m. And I have no memory of doing anything else other than listening to him. If I had lunch or went to the restroom or got something to drink, I don't remember that. I didn't take any notes. I just said, start where you are comfortable with. And I listened.
When they got to the bombing, McVeigh was relaxed, almost serene. He had no regrets. The destruction of all those lives in Oklahoma City was more than just permissible, it was mandatory, all part of his duty as a patriotic American.
He could recite the Declaration of Independence at length. He knew kind of some basic elements of the common law, necessity. I do remember as I listened, what was going through my mind was like an 8mm camera, and I was seeing in my mind these people falling to their death. And being crushed because most of the victims died as a result of traumatic injury from the collapse of the building.
As a lawyer, Stephen Jones had an incredibly difficult job in defending his admittedly guilty client. He needed to present a sympathetic version of Timothy McVeigh to the jury. So Jones interviewed him over and over, searching for any early clues as to why he killed so many people. Inside the prison, Jones sifted through every detail of McVeigh's biography.
Tim grew up in Lockport, New York. His father had a union job, same kind of job his father had. He worked on the assembly line.
The McVeighs were a blue-collar family living just north of Buffalo. Tim's father, Bill, worked the night shift at the Harrison Radiator Factory for 30 years. In 1963, Bill McVeigh met Tim's mother, Mildred, nicknamed Mickey, at a DeSales Catholic High School alumni bowling event.
And Mr. McVeigh Sr., the dad, kind of had a routine to life. He bowled every Thursday, And maybe every year, every other year, he and some of his buddies on the line would go to Las Vegas.
Bill and Mickey were mismatched from the start. Bill was dutiful and a homebody. Mickey was bubbly and outgoing. She had wanted to be a flight attendant, but settled for a part-time job as a travel agent. They both drank. Bill, beer. Mickey, whiskey sours. And they built a conventionally unhappy life together. Bill and Mickey would have three kids, two daughters and one son, Tim, the middle child.
His parents lived in a nice home. Union wages provided that. And they had a quiet middle-class life in a nice suburb of working-class blue-collar people.
As a kid, Tim liked Sesame Street and then comic books. He was an adequate student, rarely created problems, and won awards for perfect attendance.
Given the ordinariness of Tim's life, the question is, what did turn him into the man that helped in blowing up an office building and killing 168 people? That took a while, Jeff. It's like peeling back an onion. At the heart of McVeigh's psyche was a hatred of bullies. And that had started early in his life, and it was the subject of fantasies that his bedroom was next to his parents' room, and they were constantly arguing at night, particularly his mother. And he could hear all of it, the parents arguing day after day after day or night after night. And so to distract himself from it, he had a sketch pad, and he started drawing pictures of dragons and people that were standing up to them. The dragons were the bullies, and here were these helpless people. And so he began to see life as us versus them, bullies.
Bill and Mickey got a divorce in 1984 when Tim was 16.
Now, when they were divorced, the status of Tim's life changed.
Tim didn't tell anyone until much later that he felt abandoned by his mother.
A year after the bombing, Bill McVeigh was interviewed for an ABC News special hosted by Peter Jennings.
Was he upset when his mom left?
He didn't show it. I mean, now I hear now he was, but he really didn't show it.
What do you mean you hear now he was?
Well, you read all this stuff, you know, in the newspapers, and you don't know what to believe.
Bill and Tim already had a tense relationship, but now the McVeigh men were left to fend for themselves.
I get the strong impression that was very tough on you.
It was.
Mickey took custody of Tim's sisters, and they moved to Florida. Later, Tim told a coworker that his mother was a slut, whore, and drunk, and that he hated her. After the divorce, Bill and Tim downsized to a smaller home. Living alone with his dad in his final years of high school, Tim found the consuming interest in his life. Guns. It was a passion that he inherited.
What he did have was a grandfather. And Mr. McVeigh, the father's father, who was still alive. And he was a survivalist. He was a hunter. He and Tim spent a lot of time together. And I think that's the member of the family that Tim bonded the closest with.
When Tim was 9 years old, his grandfather gave him a BB gun. When Tim was 15, he applied for a hunting license, but he was never much interested in actually hunting. He just loved owning and shooting guns. Tim took a part-time job at Burger King, and he plowed most of his money into weapons. To get away from the tension in his house, McVeigh would take long walks in the woods with whatever guns happened to be around. As a teenager in the mid-80s, McVeigh joined the National Rifle Association. This happened to be a transformative moment in the politics of guns.
Greatness of America is displayed in our constitutional right to bear arms, a rich heritage and tradition that spans generations. And preserving all of this is the NRA, the National Rifle Association.
The NRA was originally founded as an apolitical organization devoted to shooting skills and gun safety. But by the time McVeigh joined, it was turning ferociously partisan.
Preserve your heritage of freedoms. Join the National Rifle Association.
For 200 years, the Second Amendment was understood to apply only to guns for state militias. But starting in the 80s, the NRA pushed the idea that the Constitution endowed individuals with the right to bear arms. McVeigh had joined an ascendant political crusade, which grew more extreme over the course of his lifetime and beyond. He quickly began devouring the NRA's publications.
For just $20, you'll receive the privileges and benefits of NRA membership, including 12 exciting issues of the American Rifleman or American Hunter magazine.
The teenage McVeigh faithfully read American Hunter, the NRA's official magazine. Leafing through pages and pages about guns, a disgruntled kid from Buffalo found something that would trigger his descent into far-right extremism. In the magazine's back pages, Tim saw an ad for a novel. After the book arrived, he read it and it changed his life. The novel was called The Turner Diaries, and it became the direct inspiration for the Oklahoma City bombing. In 2017, at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, there was a march of young white men in khaki pants and polo shirts. They were protesting the removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. While holding torches, they chanted, "Jews will not replace us." That chant embodied a deep white supremacist paranoid belief that powerful Jews were pulling on the levers of society to dilute the white race. In more recent years, during the Trump era, the slightly sanitized version of this idea is called the Great Replacement Theory.
The Great Replacement? Yeah, it's not a conspiracy theory. It's their electoral strategy.
Tucker Carlson, when he was at Fox News, helped promote this idea.
The Democratic Party is trying to replace the current electorate with new people, more obedient voters from the third world. Let's just say it, that's true. I mean, everyone wants to make a racial issue out of it. Ooh, the, you know, white replacement theory. No, no, no.
It turns out that in America, at least, one origin for the Great Replacement Theory can be found in Timothy McVeigh's favorite book. It's the central plot of the dystopian novel, The Turner Diaries.
It's difficult to overstate the influence of the Turner Diaries in thinking about the white power movement.
Kathleen Ballou is a professor of history at Northwestern University and a leading authority on the white power movement.
The book answers a really important imaginative question for this movement, which is how can a very small group of people hope to oppose the most militarized superstate in world history? How can a tiny cell of guerrillas take on the United States Army? I think the book calls this the problem of a gnat trying to assassinate an elephant.
The Turner Diaries was first published in the late 1970s, and it was written by a man named William Luther Pierce.
He was the leader and founder of probably the most preeminent hate group in the world during its time, the National Alliance.
The National Alliance was a white supremacist neo-Nazi organization. Pierce was first introduced to Nazi ideology while working as a physics professor at Oregon State University, where he opposed the civil rights and anti-war movements. Pierce wrote the Turner Diaries as a call to arms for militant racists everywhere. Here he is reading from the audiobook.
Since the publication of the Turner Diaries, it has attracted a considerable amount of attention. That attention is now spreading beyond the English-speaking world to white men and women everywhere, and it can only grow in the future.
William Luther Pierce died in 2002. Kelvin Pierce is his son.
Personally, he was an extremely abusive man. You know, he was very abusive to me. I mean, he started beating me before I was 2 years old. I mean, my first beatings were during potty training. And it just kind of escalated from there.
Kelvin was raised in the white power movement, and he believed what his dad taught him, that Jews and non-whites were responsible for all of society's ills. Kelvin's own beliefs started to change when he began mixing with different kinds of people at college, where he was on the track team.
And You know, I had invited my mom to come and come to one of my meets, and she actually said, well, your father's actually going to come. And so when he came to that track meet, I found out that the reason why he came was because I was in a college in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and that's where his publisher was. He did come to the track meet, but he showed up after the meet was over. So I only saw him for like 10 minutes. And that was my first knowledge of the book.
In the Turner Diaries, the federal government and economy are controlled by a sinister Jewish cabal known as the System. Earl Turner, the hero of the book and its narrator, leads a secret resistance group called the Organization.
It is a cancer too deeply rooted in our flesh. And if we don't destroy the system before it destroys us, if we don't cut this cancer out of our living flesh, our whole race will die.
Basically, it just tells the story of, you know, the violent overthrow of the U.S. government and the creation of a, you know, whites-only homeland in the United States, which is what my dad, every waking moment, was working toward that goal.
In the book, the system is stacked to favor black people and to discriminate against whites. Under its rules, black people are allowed to attack whites with impunity, and whites are punished for defending themselves. The plot revolves around the evils of gun control. That's why the Turner Diaries was advertised in an NRA magazine, where a young, gun-loving Timothy McVeigh found it. At the beginning of the novel, the system passes a law where all privately owned firearms are confiscated by the government. The law is called the Cohen Act. Subtle, huh? In response to the Cohen Act, Earl Turner commits an act of terrorism.
Timothy McVeigh loved the Turner Diaries. He bought many, many, many copies. You know, he drove around the country visiting gun shows, selling copies of the book to others. Sometimes he would sell the book at less than what he paid for it because he felt it was so important that people read it.
In the book, Earl Turner places a truck bomb in front of the FBI building in Washington. The book describes the making of the bomb in minute detail. Turner and his allies assemble about 5,000 pounds of ammonium nitrate fertilizer, cases of blasting gelatin, and sticks of dynamite stolen from a construction shed. When the day comes, Turner sets off the bomb without warning, killing about 700 people.
There is no way we can destroy the system without hurting many thousands of innocent people. No way.
The bombing then sets off a race war that consumes the entire country, with whites emerging victorious.
We are now settling the score with your pals in the political police. Soon we'll settle the score with you and all other traitors. White America shall live.
For the Oklahoma City bombing, the Turner Diaries was McVeigh's blueprint.
You know, the Oklahoma City bombing, that bomb that he used was almost identical to a bomb that was used in the book.
At the center of it all, of course, is the bombed out shell of the federal office building.
And in its So McVeigh basically just copied that formula, and that's what he used for his bombing.
The bomb, which may have contained the explosive equivalent of 2,000 pounds of dynamite, was apparently driven in a Ryder rental van.
And he had pages from the book in his car when he was arrested after the bombing.
Among the stack of so-called patriotic texts in McVeigh's car was a photocopied page from the Turner Diaries. McVeigh had used a yellow highlighter to mark this passage.
The real value of all our attacks today lies in the psychological impact, not in the immediate casualties. More important, though, is what we taught the politicians and the bureaucrats. They learned this afternoon that not one of them is beyond our reach.
Professor Kathleen Ballou again.
The movement that brought McVeigh to the Oklahoma City building is the same movement that brings us up to the present. This is, you know, decades, if not generations, deep.
Timothy McVeigh wanted the Oklahoma City bombing to start a revolution, just like Earl Turner did in the Turner Diaries. And across decades of far-right violence in America, that book is a straight line that connects what McVeigh did in April 1995 to what we're seeing today.
Watch, follow! Oh!
6 weeks before January 6th, on an online show called War Boys, Joe Biggs of the Proud Boys railed against those who were attempting to honor the results of the 2020 election. Then he said this.
They're evil scum, and they all deserve to die a traitor's death.
Yep. Day of the Rope.
The Day of the Rope is the cataclysmic day of violence in the Turner Diaries.
Today has been the Day of the Rope. A grim and bloody day, but an unavoidable one.
One of the things that we saw on the Capitol riot on January 6th was the prominent placement of a noose outside of the Capitol building. That's a direct reference to the Day of the Rope, which is also the kind of ritualized killing of politicians.
I'm sure that without the forceful lesson of this Day of the Rope, we would not have so quickly elicited this sort of citizen cooperation. The hangings have helped everyone get off the fence in a hurry.
There is an attack on the U.S. Capitol that's very similar. And in Turner Diaries, it's a mortar assault.
Mortars are marvelous little weapons. About 45 seconds after the second round, the third one landed on the roof of the south wing of the Capitol and exploded inside the building.
It's, I think, just six people are killed. And the goal is not mass casualty. The goal is to show that they can strike at the heart of power and awaken, quote unquote, others to their cause. That, to me, accords with the way that January 6th unfolded, where we didn't see major casualties, but we did see this intense attempt to sort of strike at the heart of power and use it as a recruitment event.
The Oklahoma City bombing and January 6th were born out of the same three ideological motives: the obsession with gun rights, the perceived approval of the Founding Fathers, and the belief in the value and legitimacy of violence. The same ideas that inspired McVeigh's rage are now everywhere in the far right.
I think when we think about an event like the Oklahoma City bombing, it's very easy to see it as a staggering, horrifying tragedy. And the way that we approach something like that almost requires us to see it as a standalone event. There are ways that that's right. That's right for the people who lost somebody that day. That's right for the city that's never had something quite like that before. But that singular moment of the bombing has such a long and dense history within the white power movement.
It took me a while to discover what the Oklahoma City bombing could teach us about today. The story I covered back in the mid-90s focused on how McVeigh and his friend Terry Nichols methodically planned and carried out their monstrous plot, and how the people of Oklahoma bravely responded. It's an amazing and horrifying true crime story, and we do tell that story in this podcast. But I'm also going to go back and do what I didn't do when I originally covered the trial. I'm going to tell you the full story of Timothy McVeigh, how a decorated Army veteran became consumed with rage at the federal government, how his anger at news events of the day spiraled him into extremism, how he somehow went underground and built a bomb that did 50 blocks of damage in a modern city, and how everything that led to the horror of April 19th, 1995 is still very present in America.
We shouldn't see this as one person, and we shouldn't see this as one event.
Coming up on Homegrown.
I was like, man, I knew something was wrong with him. I knew it. Man, this dude was a racist.
These people have come to a point where they're actually calling for a civil war. They're actually hoping it happens.
Waco was the trigger for his planning the Oklahoma City bombing.
He says, my weapon is loaded. And so I nudged him with the barrel of my weapon to the back of his head. I said, so is mine.
And he said to me, you don't understand, we're at war. I said, no, we're not. If we're at war, I have to kill McVeigh, and I would have killed you, because I have the capability.
From the day I met him, you know, he was all about the government's trying to take our guns. But the extreme behavior didn't start till after we had come back from Desert Storm.
Homegrown Oklahoma City is a USG audio podcast produced by Western Sound in association with Esmail Corp. It's reported, written, and hosted by me, Jeffrey Toobin. Executive producers are Josh Block at USG Audio, Sam Esmail and Chad Hamilton at Esmail Corp., and Western Sound's Ben Adair and Colin McNulty, who was also the editor. Production support from Josh LaLonghi at USG Audio. The producer and sound designer is Tyler Hill. The associate producer is Stella Hartman. The producer from Esmail Corp. is Sarah Maddy. Original theme and engineering by Alex McGinnis. Fact-checking by Nicole McNulty and Savannah Wright. Special thanks to Betsy Shepard and Dan Leone. Our gratitude also to the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum and to the Briscoe Center at the University of Texas. For more information on this podcast and other podcasts from USG Audio, go to our website, usgaudio.com. And to learn even more, read my book, Homegrown: Timothy McVeigh and the Rise of Right-Wing Extremism.